Welcome to The Age Stage. In this, our third episode for 2017. My name is Vicky Barber, and behind the controls we have Brody Guzet. Hey, Brody.
How are you?
I'm good. How was you? How are you?
Oh, look, I'm pretty good.
That's good.
Although this weather is knocking me about a bit.
The up and the down and the down and the up.
Well, I don't feel the cold.
Oh.
No, I usually don't. I'm quite happy. I walk around in the snow with no clothes on. It's easy. But the other day...
I'll make a mental note of that, not to go
radio.
Skiing with you.
And the other day, yesterday, I just couldn't, for some inexplicable reason, get warm, and I had to go and have a bath.
Oh.
You know, to get the core warm. It's most peculiar. I don't know what it was. And yet today, here I am... You know.
Wearing a T-shirt?
Yeah.
Oh, well. Yeah. We are in Melbourne, so to speak. So
we are.
Four seasons in a day.
We are.
Now, I wanted to let our listeners know that we now, at The Age Stage, have our very own producer.
Yes.
And her name is Lisa Gray, and she's come along and to help make us and our three amigos, who collectively bring The Age Stage together. She's pulling together interviews, a lot of topics, some great stories are going to come through in the next
season. I
think it'll
change the show completely.
Oh, definitely.
Looking
definitely.
Forward to it.
Mm-hmm. Now today we will have our panel in of Tom and Peter.
Yay.
And they'll be discussing the very important role of the village manager, but also how that plays in relation to our topic for February being health management for seniors. And after them we will be joined by a veterinary nurse by the name of Heather, and she'll be talking about pets and the benefits of pets for seniors. And then we'll be speaking with Dr. Andrew Taylor. And we'll actually be speaking to him via telephone, and that'll be about medical management when you go travelling.
Which is going to be very important for me because I'm going
off on holiday.
I am going over to see my grandchild person thing.
Your grandchild person?
Thing.
Right.
Yes. Well, it's a girl.
Okay.
We do know that.
Oh, this is the one.
This is Luna. Luna module.
Oh, right.
I'm not... Yes. Claire de la Luna. I don't know. Anyway, she's called Luna, apparently. She's not born yet.
But I was about to say. Yeah. I didn't think she'd be born.
No, she's not. She's
well...
Not. But that's all for the March. That's going to happen in June.
So. Well, that'll be exciting.
But in the meantime, we need to get our panellists in. And to do that, we need their very own
little bit of music.
Piece of music. Oh, I get by with a
Welcome back, Peter Nilsson and Tom Camp.
How's it going, Vic?
Afternoon. Gentlemen.
How are you?
Are we well?
We are well, and we're both wearing our ties today.
Both of
us. I was impressed when you walked in.
Yeah. Peter Nilsson's is done up, and my shirt's hanging out.
Tom's,
really sorry.
Tom's going for the casual look.
Yeah, I'm going for the casual tie, half out.
Very smart.
For the end of the race day look.
Very smart.
Oh, it's not that bad. End of the race day look.
Ooh, have you both been well?
Yes, thank you. Good.
Yep.
Yes, very good. Thanks, Brody.
Good to
just
hear.
Just thought the story about the bath was a bit too much information for me, though, yesterday.
Which story of the bath?
The vision of you in a bath trying to warm up.
Oh.
See, I blocked the vision out, Peter. Now you're bringing it back.
It was strange. I just could not get warm. I was literally shivering, and it wasn't that cold.
Well, apparently Sunday was the coldest day, February day, in a decade.
Mm. It was pretty cold Sunday.
Yes, it was chilly Sunday.
Must have lingered over onto the Monday.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not
maybe.
The role I've ever played as managing people in the village, to get them in the bath.
Oh, you haven't done that?
Okay.
No, haven't done that yet.
That's going a little bit...
Let's explore that, though.
I've rolled a few down the road, though.
What, village managers?
No, not village managers. They're just stalwarts of the community. They're pretty cool. Mm.
So what is the role of a village manager, Peter?
Managed and varied.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Really depending on the village and how they're operated. But in essence, I think if I want to close my eyes and imagine what is the perfect manager, I have to say a person who manages a village is the facilitator of the lifestyles of his residents and actually make things happen.
Mm-hmm.
So they join the community for lots of reasons, but once they're in the community, the manager's role is to continually challenge and present residents with information, with opportunities.
Mm. And ensure their lifestyle is...
Exactly. I think...
They're meeting their expectation.
Yeah. I think if a manager does that, in my view, he's doing his job or she's doing her job.
Mm-hmm.
But they've got it's not just about knowing what people's personal needs are. It's also about operational needs, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
So
there are some specific skills. Yeah. I think a village manager, a modern village manager today, has got to have a diverse range of management skills, you know, practical, got to understand things about OH&S. Mm. They've got to have some general understanding of health. They've got to be really...
Got to have some psychology.
They've got some psychology, like you, often in a counselling environment with family and things like that, and the different things.
Because so many stakeholders are involved, whether it's your staff, whether it's family, whether it's the resident themselves, I would expect.
I think, Pete, we were talking about earlier, they're a facilitator in so many different ways.
Mm.
And
you've got to have a good imagination, I would think, because in the sense you've got to be a problem solver.
Yeah.
And the problem presents, got to have a good, quick answer.
Yeah. And I think the manager needs to be tuned into what's happening in the community with regards of pensions and government rules and regulations. Mm-hmm. They're always changing, and then bring those into the village with experts to speak on that topic so that the residents are always abreast and are in the know of what affects them.
Yeah,
and that's what happens in our village, and I'm sure Tom's and Stuart's is we're always having seminars and get-togethers from all sorts of people about all sorts of topics, and clearly the audience of the day are the ones that's their hot point for the day.
Mm. Yeah. Well, first and foremost, I guess a healthy village, you know, a lot of healthy people, is a happy village.
Exactly. Yeah? Yep.
So I'm assuming that a manager has, if not necessarily a completely direct connection into people's health, but does influence it potentially in a great many ways in either stuff that they organise or whatever. Do you think that's the case?
Yeah.
Keeping people...
Just as an observation, you're exactly right. And out of all the people who serve residents in a retirement village, who would you think would be one of the most valuable people for the manager to know what's going on amongst staff or contractors? It's a good question, isn't it?
It's a very good question.
I've got the answer.
Well, go. Oh. Yes, otherwise we'll be here until Thursday.
Too challenged.
I want you to guess. The gardener.
Yeah.
Ah.
The gardener.
Absolutely.
The gardeners.
Because they're talking
all the time.
The gardeners are breezing past, doing what they do, and the residents clearly talk to the gardener because they're part of the family too.
Yeah.
Mm.
And the gardener, they share with the gardener what's going on in their life, and the gardener brings it to us if they think we need to know.
So if he's been cutting the weeds outside of Mavis's place and hasn't seen Mavis for a couple of days, he'll come and report it.
Absolutely.
Or she will come and report it. Do you have female gardeners?
Yes, we do.
There you go.
Absolutely.
Mm.
Do you have transgender gardeners? Well, you know, covering all the bases, I suppose somebody must somewhere.
I'm not going there.
It's just politically correct, you know.
Yes.
So, all right. Well, that's interesting. Mm. You know, a gardener, you wouldn't be a confessor, but it's they're so close.
It is, yes, because they don't feel that they're a staff. They're a staff member, but they don't feel like they're a carer, even though they're caring for their garden, etc. Yep. So they can probably feel quite open with them, and the gardener's probably quite relaxed with them.
They are relaxed.
Building a relationship with them. So I actually find it a really interesting one.
Yeah. Well, the gardener's moving around the whole of the village.
Yes.
Right? Whereas, you know, usually the management and the front of house is just that. It's at the central, usually in the community centre and the offices and so on. So people actually come to the community centre and the offices to engage, whereas the gardener's out and about.
Mm.
I don't know what the statistics are in your village, but we only get about, you know, 45% of our residents use the community centre on a you know, a daily basis, regular basis.
Yeah.
You know, it's very much different strokes, different folks.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to also say, you made the comment about health earlier, Brody. My philosophy, and I really got this off you, Pete, is that the village manager is the start to finish. He meets and greets you, or she meets and greets you from day one when you first visit the village, and then is with you in the transition when you move in, and then right throughout. So a village manager has a very good understanding of the individuals or couples as they come, their health issues and so on. And even in our contract forms, when we're working through powers of attorney and medical attorneys and the family and things like that, we are privy to good information, good background information on you know, the well-being and health of our residents.
So it is very much the village manager's role. If I was to come in with a family member or whatever, I'm actually speaking to really the top person, and that's part of their role is actually ensuring all of that.
Not in all villages, but in most villages, the manager is a key part of initial sales inquiries.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. So when you lose a manager, it must be like sort of losing a member of the family.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Mm. Fortunately, we don't. That doesn't happen very often, does it? Mm. I don't know about you.
Well, I've been there 24 years, so yeah. I'm nearly at my use-by date.
Well, I think not with a slick haircut like that, mate.
But it's I can imagine that it's not it by definition it's a 24/7 imaginary job, if nothing else, because it's a living thing.
Yeah.
So I would assume there must be a certain level of burnout of people looking after these looking after villages. I would have thought that it would be. It would be. It's not an easy role, I don't suppose. It would be a demanding role.
I think particularly of the smaller villages where there's maybe the manager and a receptionist and that's it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That would be difficult.
Yes, because they're not getting much help.
I'm lucky and, like, I've got a manager of the village and I'm the general manager, if you like. So we've got a whole team of people we can bounce off and share things with. Yeah. Very important to keep yourself... together, really, because yes, there are times
you take on ownership and spiritual ownership as much as anything.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, and one of the good things about industry associations and like the old Retirement Village Association, and more recently the Property Council, is they have functions of managers where they get together. So for the smaller villages, it's great to be able to know who the manager down the road is and meet them socially to talk about and be able to ring them up and share. Because a long time ago, Chaz said to me, he's got some great sayings, he said to me, you know, Pete, nothing in this world is new, it's just new to you.
Yes.
So there are other people who've shared and had experience in the problem you're facing. You've got to find out who that person is and ask them.
And learn from them.
Yeah. And Stuart Shaw and I have that relationship for a long time where we ring each other about, Stuart, guess what's just happened? He said, oh, yeah, that happened to us 10 years ago and this is what we did.
Right.
So it's great to have that camaraderie against colleagues to share and help them in their roles. But yes, I think in the larger villages where there's more staff, it's in somewhat respects easier because you've got that support. In the smaller villages, it's a far more multidisciplined approach from the manager, and some managers do get burnt out because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah, so their owners have to be well aware of that.
Yeah. Totally agree.
Now, in this health space. I know that you don't have your own catering facilities, do you?
Yes, we do.
Oh, do you? You have your own catering facilities. Mm-hmm. All right. So let's have a think then about in terms of this health issue for people. Diet and the when I say diet, I mean the food that you select to cook, or the fact that people select, particularly when they become solo, they've been a couple perhaps and they've become solo, they're cooking for one and all that sort of stuff. Do your kitchens think about diet and that sort of stuff when they put the food together, or is it?
Well, yes and no. Our kitchens, you've got to understand that retirement villages, generally speaking, in our cohort, are independent living.
Yes,
so
correct.
They live like you and I live.
Yes.
So our restaurant is a restaurant. It's not.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're going out and they're choosing from
diets.
The menu.
Correct. Correct. But there does come a time where residents get to a point in their life where they're maybe on the cusp of living independently, living alone. There's a few classic signs of when people are not managing. Clearly personal hygiene is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Have a look in the fridge is another.
Mm.
So the government have home care package, which we talked about with Katie a week or so ago. One of that process is that when people are on packages and food and diet is an issue, amongst the team of support would be a dietitian to come in and recommend a diet. And then the home care package people would make sure that the food that's prepared follows the diet of the needs of the resident concerned. Mm-hmm. So, yes, there is a whole range of allied health people who work in villages. But in essence, though, in the independent living part, no. People prepare their own meals, and when they dine out, they have a normal menu, like you and I would go to any restaurant or cafe.
So you don't have Meals on Wheels visiting?
Yes, we do.
Yeah. Oh, you do?
Okay. A lot
of that.
Yeah.
A lot of that.
Oh, you do?
Absolutely. There's a lot of people who come into the village Light and Easy and others
deliver
meals into the village, and we deliver fresh meals out of our kitchens to residents as well.
Well, there you go. You know, you do play a role in, because if nothing else, the oral pleasure, the joy that you get from flavour, and not just another miserable peanut butter sandwich or. And
we certainly encourage people who are living alone, rather than we deliver the meal to them, come and have it
come
with us.
Have it with us.
So they come centrally, and then they're they're communicating or
eating is a social thing to do.
Being with other people as well.
It's not fuel. It should be social. So
yes.
Clearly it's fuel, but it's better to eat with others because you get that connectivity between people. It becomes far more enjoyable. You find when people are living alone and are lonely, it becomes a chore to eat, so they don't eat, and then their health suffers.
I reckon that's the big thing, Pete, and this is what the we're talking about village management and what a village is trying to facilitate. We have a bit of a mantra that is we want to be able to put our hands on our heart and make sure that we have given every opportunity for people to engage in any activity, whether it's health, nutrition, whether it's exercise, whether it's connectivity, social outings, whatever it is, travel and so on. If we've helped put the opportunity in front of the residents, we're not doing life for them. They still have to do the life, and
they still have to make the choices.
They still have to say, yes, I will engage. Because people at different stages in life, you know, take time out or they don't want to be around people or whatever. It's just a matter of being aware of that. But we try and make sure that every opportunity, every day for every person to engage for well-being and for, I suppose, finishing their race well and feeling good about themselves. Because if you can help them feel good about themselves, everybody's happy. And that's what we do. And that's what all of our staff try and do, is to make sure the opportunities are there. And it's not often about doing the things. It's not often about the bowling. It's not often about the men's workshop or the community workshop. It's actually making sure that people are active, people are engaging, keeping everything moving and ticking, whether it's body, mind and spirit, to do that. And that is really the role of the management, to facilitate that. So that takes intuition, understanding, all of those things about just how a person's wired, just what turns them on, just what motivates them, etc. And that probably sums up what we do.
So do you spend time asking the residents as well, like, is this working, is this not working, like focus group type thing, for want of a better term?
We do an annual resident survey.
To get their feedback and see what you're doing really well or areas of improvement.
Now, you've actually got two different philosophies. We've been down this road before. You've got a lot of in-house facilities.
Yes.
And you've got a lot of external facilities that you take people to, don't you? So you don't have it in-house, you have it in the community. Your people go to the community to enjoy your golf or whatever, your bowls and things, but you've got that on now. So therefore, both of you, by default, are architects of activities for people, which is a health issue. But you get people outside.
Correct. Well, no, what we actually are is architects of good community. And depending on what community you're in, depending on how people actually do life, depending on the values that drive the way they do life, it just so happens in the regional towns where we are, we're not trying to take people out of the community. We're trying to keep them active, involved. And yes, they might come inside a community at night time and a gate closes at 9 o'clock for the safety and security reasons. We're not trying to take them out of anything. We're trying to continue to keep them engaged. The reality with big city living is just that. That's why the city retirement villages often have all the amenities in-house, because of the sheer size. If you even take Pete's and Stuart's, you guys would be just about the largest ones in Victoria anyway.
We are.
You know, Pete's village, I'm allowed to talk about Village Glen, is probably two villages in one. You know, because it's been built over a period of 30 years. So you've got architecture, it's a town.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, that's a pretty diverse community. I would have thought, what, 1,000, 1,100 residents?
We've kind of got just over 800 residents. And if you count the aged care, it's 1,100.
It's 1,100. There you go. So, I mean, that's a huge community of people that you're wanting to add value to their lives, because that's what it's about. Whereas where I come from, I've got architect community to make sure they're connecting with it. See, in the regional areas, the volunteer groups are very active mm-hmm. and very relevant. And whereas I don't see the same, other than church communities. And
well,
how are you finding it? Is it changing? Oh, look, I would have said it's changing because the value system's changing.
In our aged care, we have, I think, 67 volunteers who come into the aged care facility. 64 of them are from the Village Glen.
That's really good.
So they do an amazing job. It never ceases. It tickles my fancy a bit, actually. There's one group, and they have a lolly cart. And every Thursday, they go around to every resident in the aged care with this, like we used to go to the movies and there was a tray with, you know, Jaffers and things on it. Well, this is what they've got. And they go and visit everybody and they buy lollies or sweets or newspapers or magazines. So there's a whole range of things on this cart. Mm. And it's not about the goods on the cart. It's about the time they spend in the room. And a lot of residents don't buy anything, but they're there for 10 minutes or so. Mm,
yeah.
And the way it brightens up the day of the resident to have a person of a similar age, there might be a generation below them, but they're a similar age, talking to them about current issues at the village, because 40% of our residents in the aged care formerly were in the village, so they've, you know, aged into the aged care facility. It's sensational. It's great. And one of the great things about that is running residential facilities is a very expensive business. You know, salaries, 70% of our expenses are salaries.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone is, because of that, everyone's working full on. They haven't got the time. One of the things wrong with the world today is no one's got time anymore for people.
It's true.
Mm-hmm.
So the volunteers are the ones who spend that time and give quality time to residents in the aged care, whereas the professional staff are doing what they do to support them from a physical point of view, but not from a mental or other support, you know, those other support activities.
So, well, I can just hope that your two facilities remain happy and healthy and wise and things for them all the time ahead, because that completes our time with our special and honoured guest panel this week.
Honoured.
Special and honoured.
Yes, as indeed you are. Gentlemen, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And we look forward to seeing you next week. Are you both coming in next week, do you know?
I know Stuart certainly isn't. Stuart. We haven't talked about
Stuart.
Oh, we haven't seen Stuart for a while.
Stuart's back.
Right.
Oh.
So,
yeah.
All right. Well, just to remind him.
We're going to call him Arnold Schwarzenegger. I'll be back.
Just remind him that we're still talking about health management for seniors, and we would like to be exploring things like living with carers, in you know, how that works.
Yes.
And potentially technology and health management. So what you might have in place in terms of technology and stuff.
Or what might be coming
or what you might think is coming around the corner.
Speak. Yes.
Mm. Like the new scooters and the like.
New scooters.
Yes, you never know.
Welcome back to the Age Stage. And with us we have veterinary nurse Heather Doyle. Welcome, Heather.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hello, Heather.
How are you?
Look, I'm thrilled that you're here because I think this is going to be a really interesting topic, the role of pets for senior citizens.
Yes, that's right.
What is, in your opinion, the most ideal pet for a senior? A rat? Well, it could.
A rat? A lizard?
A tarantula?
Something that's
dog or a cat?
Easy, I suppose, and it really depends on size as well as people's preference. So for me, a small dog is the most popular. Cats are also very popular.
Mm-hmm. Something that they can have sit on their lap or
something
like that. Something
that's portable. That's the biggest thing because, trying to get big dogs in and out of cars and around and all that sort of thing. So something small, if they want really easy, cats are probably better. If they want something easier than that, perhaps a bird. So there's lots of things that are great for older people.
And sometimes a bird can chat back to you, can't you? You can teach them to say something so you can get a little bit of extra conversation from them.
Yeah, that's right.
What's the most challenging thing about being a vet nurse?
Oh, it's probably just how hard it is sometimes when you're dealing with animals that have to be put to sleep or, you know, just the difficult side of things. But as a general rule, it's a fantastic job because every day is different. You know, you come across a whole range of animals. The amount of times that you can help people is fantastic, but it does have its difficult, sad side to it too. So But yeah. It's something I've done for 26 years and I really like it.
Because people don't come to vets for a cup of coffee, do they? They've got a problem.
Yeah, no, so that's exactly right. Yeah. And I was there this morning. I don't work at a vet clinic anymore. I'm self-employed, so I do things from home. But, yeah, mm-hmm. having to take my cats in to actually have them vaccinated this morning, it was different sitting on the other side of the desk and, you know, just being a client rather than, you know, the reception or the nurse or whatever it was. So, yeah, it can be quite a challenging place to go to with your animals.
Mm. What sort of unusual pets do people have?
Oh, reptiles, there's all sorts. I haven't worked at clinics with exotic animals as such, but people do come in with reptiles. So if there's a sort of a mixed practice or there's a vet there that can deal with poultry or, you know, reptiles or things like that, you do see something more unusual come through.
I do have to tell you a funny story.
Okay,
as we're talking about reptiles, I had a note from my son the other day and about a 20-kilo python got hold of their pet rabbit.
Oh.
Oh, no.
And he'd never heard a rabbit scream before. And they do.
Oh, yeah.
And he went outside and he said, "Drop it! Drop the rabbit!" And then he realised what he was doing.
He was actually completely
naked out in the middle of the street shouting at this python. It was totally deaf.
I think once it's halfway in, he's not going to drop it, is he?
He actually did manage to get it out. Oh. And they took it to the vet and it had got... It was all right, but it got a tooth stuck in its head.
Oh,
so it had,
Remove that. I would expect.
How traumatic for the poor rabbit.
It was, yes. So he's now got a rabbit-proof, I mean, a python-proof cage for the bunny.
Oh, goodness.
So I don't know what that cost, but it's not cheap. No. And on that issue of cheap, pet insurance is a relatively new thing.
It is, and it's becoming more and more popular.
Yeah,
and I would recommend that people get pet insurance from the moment they get their pet, usually,
well,
preferably from when they're a baby, because the minute they have an illness or an ear infection or skin problems, it's a pre-existing illness and the insurance won't cover it.
I was just recently reading something about that because I'm in the market to hopefully get a dog. So I was reading up on all of these.
Yeah, I would.
So I was interested in your insurance comment.
Yeah, and it's actually not as expensive as you think. Like ours, you know, cost several hundred depending on the extras and that sort of thing every month. But as far as I know, depending on the company.
Several hundred a month?
Health insurance. Oh, it does for me and my kids.
Oh, sorry, I thought you were about pets.
Yeah, but no pets. So compared to us, pets are more I don't know, $1 a day or, you know, up to $2 a day, I suppose. So they're not that expensive, but again, it depends on your coverage and all that sort of thing. But
Do health insurers cover pets as well? Like, can you get an extension for your pets?
Medibank actually has an animal coverage on there. So does your house insurance. Often
your house insurance.
They don't advertise the fact that they do, but often, not all, but if you ring your house insurance people, they will have a pet insurance policy as well, and then you get multi-policy discounts. So that's interesting to know. But so you've just really got to look in, because they all offer different things, and you've just got to choose which is best for you. And
the dilemma, of course, is if you've got, I mean, in all honesty, if you take this bunny.
Yes.
Right? Now it's a $3 bunny or whatever it is that you pay for a bunny.
It's a cheap bunny.
Cheap rabbit.
Yeah. Well, Heather and I are going, where did they get the bunny?
But what do you pay for a bunny then?
Oh, I don't exactly know, but I know it's not $3. No, I would say that you're probably more like $100 or so.
Yeah.
Well, they were charged $600 to get this, you know, to give it mouth-to-mouth resuscitation and say it was all right, give it psychological guidance or whatever you do to a bunny and remove the tooth.
There's good people out there, aren't there? But not everyone would pay that much, but the ones that do are good people.
But that's the point.
The pet becomes part of your family.
Well, I know, but the cost... my daughter's dog, it had a ligament that went, and it was $3,000, and they were doing experimental stuff.
Yeah.
So they said, "We'll do it for you for half price. It's experimental, so either we'll have to chop the leg off afterwards because it won't work, or we're not right." So we did that, and we paid for that one, and then she went away, and the other one had to be done, and they said, it works so well, we're going to do that one again." Yeah. It's kind of cost you three.
The biggest problem is they spend so much time weight bearing on the other leg because they've got one that's post surgery that they often do the other one. So you do have sort of areas where you can choose different surgeries for different procedures. So cruciate ligament surgery, for instance, might have three different procedures you can do. So you pay an amount per surgery, depending on whether they use toggles or, you know, all sorts of things. So,
but it is expensive. The vet experience is expensive.
Yeah, that's right. Again, that's why health insurance is so important, because most of the time they'll cover those sort of surgeries.
Well, the 26-cent solution, of course, is always that.
You have to be careful which breed you get, because now they're cottoning on to how expensive certain breeds are. So, you know, insurance companies will be a bit difficult insuring certain breeds too.
Now, that's important.
Is that to do with the certain pedigree type breed?
Yeah, because certain breeds are predisposed to all sorts of hip dysplasia or injuries or something like that. Yeah. And, you know, the bigger the dog, the more expensive the treatment. So Great Danes, you know, the big dogs.
So could I come to a vet and say, look, I'm going to get... You're going to get a dog, and we're going to get it from the pound or whatever. Mm. What dogs? Pre-loved. What sort of dog do you recommend that we get, or what sort of dogs do you suggest that we avoid? Will they give that?
Yeah, they advice? Will. Vets can actually tell them. Nurses are, you know, good to talk to as well, because they can see the temperament of certain breeds. You used to be able to say that you could just go and get a mixed breed mutt. They used to call them for $150. Yes. Now they're all designer breeds, so. It's difficult to say, because unfortunately a lot of them are oodles, so they've got poodles of some sort in there, and when you cross a poodle with something else, they tend to go nuts most of the time. So you get the spoodles, the labradoodles, schnoodles, you know, there are exceptions to the rule, but a lot of oodles these days are quite silly, so I try and steer people away from oodles. But then I've got clients who, you know, they wouldn't have anything but their oodle again, so they've obviously struck a good one. So, but as a general rule, they're very prone to anxiety. You can't leave them alone, you know, it just makes it very hard, and they're just a bit silly, and they take years, 6-8 years sometimes to calm down, and it's a long time to wait for a pet to calm down. Yes. So I have trouble these days trying to recommend particular breeds to people, because there's lots of little white fluffies that are fantastic. You know, Jack Russells can be great, but they really have different temperaments, and you have to suit them. And you have to think about long hair, short hair. You know, long hair is obviously difficult to maintain and expensive. Short hair is easy.
But you got to wash them.
Yeah.
Or if you have a noodle.
Yeah, that's right. They've got to be clipped all the time as well. So, you know, people love them with long coats, but maintaining them, you know, without any mats in their hair is difficult. So they always need clipping. You know, something easy like a little compact Jack Russell, but, you know, then again, they can be, being terriers, they can be quite yappy and a bit funny about other dogs. And so it's really hard. I don't have a particular... My favourite breed is a Golden Retriever, but they don't suit
older people because of the size and the hair loss.
And, but, you know, they are just the most happy-go-lucky, amazing dogs. Something in a smaller package, which is the same as a Golden Retriever, I'd say, is a Cavalier. But, again, they've got long hair, so they need grooming. But, you know, they are just like a Golden Retriever in a small package. So I quite like the Cavies. They do have a lot of heart problems and sorts of things. They've got a skull brain issue that goes on too. So it's hard for me as a vet nurse to recommend something because there is a lot of health problems with certain breeds of dogs. And you used to be able to say, as I was trying to get to that point, is if you get a crossbred dog, you tended to get a hardier dog.
Yeah.
But then these days you're kind of seeing a lot of Cavalier issues if you've got a Cavoodle, say.
So, yeah.
Yeah, but anxiety. So you then
got a stupid, you got an anxious poodle.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, I shouldn't say, but my mum's had poodles her whole life, and she's just moved to the UK, so I can say it. She's always said how wonderful they are, and they are intelligent, and they're great little dogs, but I just find they're very anxious and neurotic as well.
Right.
And, you know, and I do some grooming, so of course I'm requiring them to be, or to put them through a lot that they don't like, so I sometimes see the worst in a dog. So, you know, to be fair, a lot of dogs can be great family pets. When they come to the vets or come to the groomers, they're a completely different dog.
And because they know that they're going to be grabbed in a certain way.
And they're just on edge. The anxiety comes out, you know, they're neurotic even more than normal. So, so poodles are quite nice, but but everything these days is just crossed with a poodle. So you get that neurotic anxiety side of things.
That's really interesting.
Do vets give senior discounts?
Yeah, they do. So, again, it's usual if you've got a particular pension card. Not all do, but, you know, for the ones that I've worked
with. But don't be embarrassed about asking.
Yeah, everyone needs to ask, you know, because there are, you know, we all understand that it gets difficult when you've retired. So some do, some don't. But as a general rule, if you've got a pet, it's going to be expensive. And the first year of life is often the most expensive, because you've got, you know, they're growing at a rapid rate, so more food, medications, vaccinations, de-sexing, all that sort of thing comes into it, and then you get a bit of a lull, and hopefully they don't hurt themselves, and then towards the end stage of their life as well becomes very expensive.
But when you assume that a dog's going to, working on a dog, it's going to last 10 years, for argument's sake, you've also got to think about you, because you don't particularly want to go before the pet and just leave it.
Yeah, that's a big thing. And I get a lot of people, I've got a lot, and most of my clients actually that I do dog walking for, they're actually older, and they all worry that the animals that they've got are going to leave them before they do, which they often do, and they're going to be sad about it. And they all say, I'm never going to get another one. Or if I do, it's got to be an older one, which is great because you can actually take on these older dogs. You can do all sorts of things, fostering. There's plenty of stuff you can do. But if you take on a young dog, not only are they out of control and they're difficult and you've forgotten what puppies are like, you've got to worry that the family's then got to take the responsibility on if you do go before the animal.
Yes, of course.
So there's a lot of big things. My dad lost his Jack Russell about 3 or 4 years ago, and he's always vowed he's never going to get another dog, but he's got no one to talk to. So he always says, it's amazing, I used to sit and watch the news and
talk to the dog
about the weather or whatever, you know, and or when he'd go away on holiday in the Winnebago, the dog was always there. That's why I'm thinking Jack Russell sort of sizes, you know, always good, and they love to go on adventures, and they're pretty tough, hardy dogs. And Dad always said, if I get another one, they live to be 15, 18, 20, these little guys. So, so he doesn't know what he would do. So he's just decided no, which a lot of older people do, and that's fair enough too.
That sort of gets us to our time slot, I'm afraid. Will you come back and join us again at some stage?
Yeah.
We'd love to have you back in.
Thanks, Heather. Yeah. Thank you very much.
We might talk about a specific thing like cats next time.
Yeah.
It's terrific.
Yeah. Crazy cat ladies.
That could be me one day.
Now, So what is your business then?
My business is actually Vet Nurse at Home. So, you know, if anyone's got access to the internet, there is a website. So www.vetnurseathome.com.au.
Oh, great.
And there's all sorts of things that I cover. The information's on there. So.
Terrific.
Thanks, Heather.
Thanks for lovely. Thanks lovely to see you.
And you're still with the Age Stage. And now we have Dr. Andrew Taylor on the line with us. Hello, Andrew. So, Andrew, what are some of the issues that we would need to consider if we're a senior and we're planning a trip, whether it be local or overseas or whatever? What are some of the considerations we might need to think of?
First of all, good on you for getting out and moving. It's a little bit easier sometimes just to sit down and not travel anywhere, isn't it?
Mm. Oh, that's true. That's true.
But yes, there are some challenges. And if you've got medical issues and you're on long-term medication, make sure you discuss that with your family doctor before you go. For example, if you're on warfarin, you need to have those blood tests every week or two. And people sort of forget that.
Right.
Because they have their routines, and routines change. If there's some medications that, if you run out of, it's not a big problem. But there's a lot of medications that, for example, I'm thinking of hormone replacement therapy there. You'd probably rather not run out of it or lose it, but it's not the end of the world if the hot flashes come back, is it?
No.
But it's not going to ruin your trip.
On that issue of requiring to have that test, for example, so yeah. I'm going away to Europe for 3 weeks. Is it? Would the doctor give me something so that I can take it to a hospital or a clinic in Sweden or America or wherever I am so that they can continue on with that sort of...
Yes, you need to actually be across it yourself because you've got to find where you are at a medical centre that speaks English.
Yep.
Warfarin is, for example, an international brand name or generic name. Everybody knows what warfarin is in every country and they know what blood tests you have. It's unfortunate your doctor hasn't changed you to one of the NOACs that we all got in trouble for prescribing because Big Pharma's taking us out for lunch every day. Why didn't your doctor change you to that? Brady?
I don't know. Is it,
you don't know, but you're still on warfarin, I guess, or you know someone that is.
Yes.
You may contemplate changing to the drugs, the Pradaxas and so forth, because they really do make life safer and easier. You just take the same dose every day, and you don't have to worry about the blood test. And in fact, the reason they've proven so popular is the risk of stroke, spontaneous stroke, hemorrhagic type, leading into the brain, in which there's no recovery, the risk is half that of being on warfarin. and given that you're taking these drugs to prevent basically another sort of stroke, it's terrible that if you have to still be on warfarin, some people have to be, the new drugs aren't for everyone, but that just, you're might be a time to just bring that up with your doctor. Would I be suitable for going on this, these newer drugs that are getting all this publicity that seems safer and easier to take?
I would assume that there are a certain number of drugs which would be quite difficult to take into a foreign country.
Well, I don't know if you're aware, but I work in drug addiction. So most of my patients are carrying an enormous quantity of drugs that are very illegal to travel. Not a problem when they're going to Bali and so forth. They seem to manage that in Thailand. But, for example, in the USA and Canada, as you land there at Tom Bradley in Los Angeles and they ask you, are you carrying narcotics? And if you answer yes, that's the end of your trip. If you answer no, well, I hope you get away with it. And maybe why did you choose to go to this part of the world? That's for my patients. Those are the worst. Codeine, of course, is considered a narcotic by some countries and others are completely relaxed. That's sort of available. That sort of information is well available on things like Smart Traveller and your doctor, if he's running a computer medical record system, probably has a pop-up that will tell him things like that. If you're asking information, for example, if you go to Vietnam, he can press the button for Vietnam and tell you what vaccines you need, when you need to have them, and, for example, what anti-malarials you might need. So he can do the travel thing too for you, which is a lot cheaper than going to a travel medical specialist. They generally cost an enormous amount of money. And we'll sell you a lot of vaccines for diseases that you've either never heard of, B, very unlikely to get, or C, really don't matter.
Do you think it's wise to have a pre-trip medical?
Yeah, go and see your doctor and make sure you do it a good 6 weeks or so before. So you've got a chance to optimise your medication. In Australia, as an Australian, one of the great things, say you're travelling for more than 4 weeks, your doctor can write your scripts and annotate them with a thing called Regulation 24, which permits you to collect from the chemist more than 1 month's supply. That can be, in fact, up to 6 months' supply. You don't get them any cheaper, but you do at least get them in bulk. And you can then take them in your hand luggage. You never carry important medications in the hold of the plane, do you? You don't want your suitcases and medicine going to California when you're going to London.
That's true.
Do you have to carry a letter or something that states why you're holding so much of that prescription?
Yes, and everyone does. And that's a very straightforward thing for your doctor to type there and then. In terms of customs, it's not a problem because most customs departments are very familiar with medications and they'll look at the box and the box has your name, it has your doctor's name, it has the chemist's name, and it has the contents, including the generic format, so they can punch in, for example, a name like Fruzamide, which they might be wondering what that is, and find out that that's just Lasix, and that's fine. You're certainly allowed to carry that. And anyway, it's in a box with your name on it, and it's clearly been prescribed by an Australian doctor. That'll just be waved through. It won't get a second look.
And I also suppose that you should carry with your paperwork, you should have something very clear that says, in the event of an emergency, ring my doctor with these details.
Yes, most of the places you're likely to go are 12 hours out of sync. It's not bad to have an email address if your doctor has one, as most of us do nowadays. We may not be very good at getting that email, but...
at least you try.
We will eventually get back to
you. You can always ring the kids and get them to talk to them.
Or email them, most places in the world have overseas or English-speaking medical services, be it a company like SOS, which I think SOS Proprietary Limited now has something like 1,200 doctors working around the world in various locations, providing services to expatriates and foreigners on holiday. I said that like dismissively and negatively. In fact, no, they're very, very good. They provide such an amazing service that I wish I had have thought of the business model myself 20 years ago.
Now, Deep vein thrombosis. Is it something we really need to be aware of?
Well, I've seen a few in my life, yes.
Right.
And I think people do die and they do get sick. I mean, it used to be very, very hard to manage. You know, aspirin doesn't prevent it. You had to have an injection of Clexane at the airport or something and it was all set up. But now, remember I was talking before about warfarin and Pradaxa?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One Pradaxa tablet before the long trip back. Your doctor, your GP's probably got boxes of samples there. Should have. The drug's being well marketed. They'll just give you two tablets, one for each long leg of the journey.
So could you spell that, what it is?
P-R-A-D-A-X-A. That's I'll give it a brand name. Why not give them free publicity?
Well, it's important.
They've done the research.
Yeah.
What about wearing the compression type stockings and socks?
Yes, of course you can do it. If you prefer not to take medications, that's certainly fantastic.
So they do work and do assist then if you're doing the long term or the long haul flight.
I don't know of any study that's compared the stockings to the anticoagulant.
Oh, right.
The studies generally in hospital for prophylaxis of DVT, prevention of DVT, generally could do the stockings during the high risk period and the anticoagulants at other times. I think for me, I would much rather take the anticoagulants. I don't know that they're very, very effective. The stocking, I'm always worried that it's going to be a tourniquet, it's going to itch, I'm going to roll it down, I'm going to lose it. But I'm probably not a high risk group, so I'm probably not going to spend the $50 to buy them.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the tablets are basically free from your doctor's sample cupboard.
Well, but Dr.
It is a real risk. So, vaccines.
Yep.
I suppose we should talk them. You've got to have the common ones. You've got to have the flu.
Yep.
What else were you? Were there any particular things you were thinking about?
No.
Travel insurance?
No. And in any case, we have desperately, unfortunately, run out of time. So.
I hope I've given you something
to think
about. You have.
It's been definitely terrific. Dr. And we'd love to have you back again if we may, Dr. Taylor.
Anytime. Thanks, Vicky.
And we'll this time we'll make sure you get the questions in advance. So that you
don't no, that's probably me.
Tremendously helpful. Tremendously.
I'm 80-year-old. I'm out for lunch today, so I probably missed the email. See ya.
All right, Dwayne. Lovely to talk to you. Thanks, Dora.
Thank you.
Bye.
Well, there we go. Now, that really gets us towards the end of our show.
Another week. Another week over.
Yeah, it's sort of getting that way.
Mm.
Well, we've got our outro music, which is sort of saying goodbye. Now you've got something to read.
I do. So the 38th annual Easter Bonsai Show is on Saturday 15th of April and Sunday 16th of April at Belcombe Grammar. So if you'd like to get along to that, yes.
Next
sounds
week,
like fun.
Living with carers.
And technology.
Technology management.
Yeah.
Technology with health management.
Yes.
Well, it's been a great show.
It has been.
I thought the boys were terrific to start with too.
Yes.
And nice to get new guests.
It is always good to get
and
some
and we hope they'll
fresh
become
blood.
Part of the arsenal.
Yes.
Quivers in your bow, all that sort of stuff. See you next week.
See you next week, Brody.
All right, my dear.
Take care.
Bye.